At Giant Eagle, you may have spotted the Stacker. With uncanny MyPerks ability, she stacks up the perks to choose either dollars off or up to 20% off her entire grocery bill. The Stacker, stacking up huge savings with MyPerks. Find your MyPerksonality and transform your shopping into free gas and groceries. Full details at GiantEagle.com/MyPerks. Perks cannot be earned or redeemed on select items. Restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to All Indians Matter. I'm Ashraf Engineer. Data privacy was an ambiguous matter, legally speaking, for a long time until 2017 when the Supreme Court ruled that privacy was a fundamental right. However, whether your data gathered by various entities from the government to the apps that you use is secure is a gray area. In recent times, the gathering of personal information for Aadhaar, as well as what is accessible via WhatsApp and Facebook, have been the subject of great controversy. So, how safe is your data?
All Indians Matter.
We have on the show Apurva Singh, a volunteer legal counsel with the Delhi-based Software Freedom Law Center, or the SFLC. She is the center's project lead for its privacy and data protection project, and also handles its parliamentary outreach. Apurva has been involved in the Arogya Setu litigation by SFLC in the Bombay and Karnataka High Courts. She has also worked extensively on SFLC's encryption project. Prior to this, she was a legislative assistant to Members of Parliament Fellow. Conceptualized by PRS Legislative Research, the fellowship is a platform for young Indians to engage with policymaking at the national level by working with a Member of Parliament. Welcome to the show, Apurva.
Hi, Ashraf. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome.
Yeah.
You're very welcome, Apurva. Apurva, why is data privacy important for individuals?
So, you know, compare it with the data privacy in offline space. So take, for example, you know, how protective people are of sharing their IDs or bank account details with their neighbors or any third person, because they're scared of being scammed by those persons in the offline space. Now, right. As more of our data becomes digitized, we share more information online with a lot of third parties as well, knowingly or unknowingly. So this data privacy is taking a greater importance in that digital space. And again, in the digital space, you have to be aware about with whom you are sharing your personal or sensitive personal data. And which is why I believe that data privacy is quite important for individuals in the digital space as well. So when we talk about data privacy, we essentially focus on, you know, rights of individuals with respect to purpose of data collection and processing. Then the privacy preferences they have, for example, your preferences in your social media feed, where people, for example, these days are locking their Facebook profile because they do not want anyone, any third party who is not in their friend list to access anything which is personal or sensitive, sensitively personal to them. So, right. You know, it's about how the data is shared, archived, deleted, etc.
Right. But Apurva, let's talk about what's so much in the news nowadays. WhatsApp said, claiming that users' data is safe with it and that it is not being compromised in any manner. So I'll just give the listeners some perspective. Recently, WhatsApp informed users of a policy change through a pop-up in the app. The change allowed WhatsApp to integrate better with the Facebook family of services and laid the groundwork for businesses to interact with their consumers. Users were given a certain period of time within which to agree, failing which WhatsApp would not work on their phones anymore. So what was the problem with this policy change?
So, you know, there was this very interesting line in the newspaper ads which WhatsApp had come up with, which said that respect for your privacy is coded into our DNA. So it's very interesting because this line was present in the previous privacy policy, but the updated privacy policy did remove this line and it was not present in it. So, you know, the problem with the policy change is that the last privacy policy of WhatsApp allowed existing users to choose not to have their WhatsApp account information shared with Facebook, you know, to improve Facebook ads or products experiences. But right. This provision was removed in the latest privacy policy update. And interestingly, this provision is also not present in the European Union's privacy policy. So it has never been present there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what you're saying is there is a special sort of a policy change, especially for India.
not India, but users across the world, except for the users in the European Union region. And the updated terms also stated that, you know, third-party services integrated with WhatsApp would now include Facebook company products. In the previous terms of service, this was limited to iCloud and Google Drive, which is where your WhatsApp data is backed up.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, it's interesting, Purva. So what's the difference? Why is it different for Europe and why is it different for the rest of the world?
Right. So if you would know, the residents of European Union are governed by something known as the General Data Protection Regulations.
Also yes, the GDPR.
Right. Interestingly, across the world, we do have a lot of legislations governing data protection, but a lot of these legislations are piecemeal legislations. For example, the United States of America does not have a specific legislation, you know, governing data protection and privacy. The state of California has come up with something, though. India is still in the process of coming up with its data protection legislation. GDPR, on the other hand, has been in play for a few years now. They have a very efficient data protection regulator as well. Also, there's this provision in the GDPR, which is a very strict provision. It states that the companies doing business in the European Union region, if they breach any of the provisions of the GDPR, they would have to pay 3% of their annual global revenues in form of fines. Now, there is a hefty fine. There are hefty regulations present in the GDPR framework, which is absent in Indian context, also in the context of other countries as well. And hence the difference in privacy policy.
Mm-hmm. Also, just coming back to the ad, Apurva, it says that WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted and private messages are not shared with Facebook. So what do you make of this claim?
So the claim is true. WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted. Just like WhatsApp, Signal, ProtonMail, Telegram, all of these services are end-to-end encrypted. Not talking about Telegram or ProtonMail here, but WhatsApp and Signal, both of them are based on something known as the Signal protocol. So WhatsApp has been built on the basis of Signal protocol. The messages you send are end-to-end encrypted. They can be verified with the person you are messaging, if your message is being read by a third party or not. Now, there is another thing which is known as data at rest and data in motion. So when WhatsApp says that your messages are end-to-end encrypted, it means that even on their servers, they cannot read those messages. And that is true. Neither Facebook nor WhatsApp can read your messages. The problem is with the metadata sharing, which means that I am so sorry about this. Is it okay, Ashraf? I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Please continue.
Yeah. So the problem is with the metadata collection and the sort of metadata which is collected by WhatsApp here.
Right. So, I mean, what exactly is metadata and how does it or does it undermine privacy in any way?
So I have seen a lot of people describe metadata as data about data, which means that it summarizes the basic information about your data, making, finding and working with, you know, particular instances of data. So take, for example, there is a document which might include a collect. So take, for example, a PDF document. So it would have details of collection of information like the author, the file size, the date on which the document was created, the date it was modified, and the keywords which are there to describe the document. So this, all of this would constitute metadata for that particular PDF document. Now, when we talk about a music file, for example, the metadata for that music file would include the artist's name, name of the album, and the year it was released. So this is, all of this describes the main data. So it is essentially data about the data and therefore is known as the metadata. Then your question was, how does it undermine privacy in any way? So before I come to that, I will tell you about how WhatsApp collects your metadata and what sort of metadata it collects. So WhatsApp collects a lot of metadata, which includes your service-related information, your diagnostic, for example, your log files, which device you are using, which browser you are using, your IP address, the mobile network data, and the phone number. And this is amongst a few things which WhatsApp collects. It also knows your area code. It has access to your phone number, your profile picture on WhatsApp, the group you are a part of, any of the groups you are a part of, etc. And all of this is metadata, and none of this is end-to-end encrypted. And this is where the difference between, you know, end-to-end encrypted contents of privacy and the metadata sharing comes into play. So all of this is collected by WhatsApp. Then when we talk about how metadata undermines privacy, so there was this very interesting post by this foundation known as the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which said that, you know, when we talk about metadata, it essentially means that WhatsApp still knows whom you texted at 2 a.m. in the night. They know which doctor you are texting to. They know which food, what small business you are ordering from, what you are ordering at 6 a.m. in the morning. They know if you are speaking to your doctor via WhatsApp. So they still have all these details. They know which groups you are a part of. And, you know, all of this information would be shared with Facebook as well, which is essentially an advertising company. And this is how metadata undermines the privacy, because you still don't want a lot of people, including, you know, malicious third parties, WhatsApp or Facebook, to know whom you're talking to at 2 a.m. in the night. Or if you have, if you're speaking to your doctor about a sensitive health condition. And, you know, when you correlate all this metadata together, then it's still possible to, you know, build a profile based on these small data points, and which is where it gets a little tricky.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I think it's an interesting point that you make, because we live our lives through our phones, right? And if somebody is actually looking at that information all the time, they essentially got a sort of a bird's eye view of your life, isn't it?
Exactly. That's exactly what happens.
Right. In fact, I read an interesting line, you know, that WhatsApp is trying to change the definition of privacy. So in the context of what we just spoke about, what exactly does this mean?
Interestingly, you know, what WhatsApp through its ads has done is, has told people that they respect your privacy because the contents of your messages are end-to-end encrypted. While this is true, this is a very narrow interpretation of a user's privacy. You know, privacy is much more broader than that. You still do not want Facebook or WhatsApp to know, you know, whom you are talking to, at what time you are talking to them, about what maybe, and, you know, when you are talking to and whom, etc. So these, and you don't want WhatsApp or Facebook to know what your status is, what your profile picture is, which groups you are a part of. So when WhatsApp says that, you know, when we say that WhatsApp is trying to change the definition of privacy, we say it because WhatsApp is trying to limit privacy to the contents of the message and not everything all, you know, put in together.
So, you know, in layman's terms, Apurva, what kind of information do WhatsApp and even other platforms, Facebook, Google, what is it that they collect on users? You already described some of it, but is there anything else that they pick up from what you use?
Right. This is one thing which, like, you know, your IP address, your area code, your location, etc. So these are quite few common things which these companies do collect about you. But it is also to be understood that, you know, a lot of times, like, when you're searching something, for example, if you're booking Uber or Ola, you know, using your browser, so you'll get this pop-up that we want to know your location. So it depends on if you want to share your location or not. So there's definitely an element of permission involved. But, you know, all the places you are visiting, for example, if you check in to a new place and you post it on Google or Facebook, they have access to that. They know you visited this particular place. And they also know how you interact with others using their services, the duration of your interaction, and they have your pictures, your information on Google Drive, which is also not encrypted. So, you know, your Google Drive, your photos on Google Drive, your documents, your sheets, etc. It's not encrypted. It's, they have access to it. Then the Wi-Fi network you're using, the signal strength, etc. And it gets more sophisticated with, you know, Facebook and Google. Facebook, for instance, you know, collects a lot of information about people, groups, accounts, hashtags, etc. and the groups you are connected to. And for Google, Google knows almost everything you have searched and deleted. All the apps you use, the extensions you use, how often you use them, where you use them, and, you know, whom you use them to interact with. And they also have access to your YouTube history, or, for example, whom you're talking to on Duo, or the on Google Meets, whom you're sending an email to, etc.
Right. And all these apps talk to each other, right? So, for example, even how many times has it happened, and how many times have we mentioned that, you know, you search for something on Facebook and on Google, and then you go to Facebook and you are bombarded with ads about exactly what you searched for.
Definitely. This happens all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's this interesting
I'm so sorry for jumping in, but there's this interesting extension if you're using Mozilla. I'm not sure if it's present on Google Chrome as well. I guess it is. It's known as Lightbeam. It basically helps you. It tells you, you know, what sort of third-party data sharing is happening on a website which you are using. So take, for example, if I am using Google Docs at a particular moment, or, you know, Facebook. So it can actually show you the third-party data sharing which is taking place at that particular point of time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, Apurva, there's a counter-argument. I mean, I've heard international experts make this, actually. You know, platforms claim that the data being collected actually leads to a more relevant and better user experience. For example, if a search engine knows your preferences over time, then it can refine your search in a manner that's more relevant to you. And many people have actually said that people don't mind giving up a level of privacy in return for that better experience. So do you have any alternative suggestions for listeners?
So I'll start with the first part. Mm-hmm. Definitely, it does make for better and greater personalization. You also need to understand the sort of business models they have. While we talk about Facebook or WhatsApp, WhatsApp is a Facebook company product, but we need to understand that Facebook is essentially not a social media company. It's an advertising company. Signal, on the other hand, which runs the Signal messaging application, is a not-for-profit organization. So they do not have any business motive here. And the more personalized the service is, the more personalized the product offered by a particular company is, the chances of it being used by a set of people increases. So, you know, collecting and processing such data definitely allow these companies to meet consumer expectations. And then these companies also know, you know, more about the kinds of goods and products they used by their customers and are interested in. And therefore, they make those sort of pitches. So this morning itself, I was just thinking about it, that, you know, how Google and DuckDuckGo are different and what sort of differences are there in the if you search for something. So for our listeners who do not know what DuckDuckGo is a very privacy-friendly search engine which does not track you. Google, on the other hand, does keep analytics about, you know, which websites you are visiting, how often you are visiting them, etc. So you'll often find very significant differences in the search results offered by these particular search engines. So this morning I was I decided to check it myself, and I was searching for the organization I'm associated with, Software Freedom Law Center. So I searched it on Google, and I also searched it on DuckDuckGo. So while Google's first search result for Software Freedom Law Center India, and that's exactly the organization I'm associated with, DuckDuckGo instead showed at least 4 or 5 different suggestions. And the last suggestion was SFLC.in. The first suggestion on DuckDuckGo was something known as the Surface Forces Logistics Center, which is also SFLC. So, you know, that happened because DuckDuckGo is not tracking me. But at the same time, then the personalization definitely goes away.
Right. So that's a very significant point. It, like you said, it only happened because Google knew that you go to that website often enough, and perhaps that you're also associated with it. You know, Apurva, there's also been some debate over where the data collected by these services is stored. So could you simplify that debate for listeners? Why is it important where this data is stored?
Right. So we started seeing this debate in India only recently. It started, I suppose, around 2016 or 2017. So this particular thing about storing of data is known as data localization, or, you know, data balkanization, because you are breaking the internet, depending on the geographical locations. So where data is stored invites the laws applicable of that territory on those data servers. So take, for example, a lot of the servers of, you know, Google maybe, or Facebook are based in the United States of America. So what happens is that law enforcement agencies particularly find it quite challenging to approach the law enforcement agencies based in USA to, you know, get data of a particular person. Right. And they rely on something which is known as the Mutual Legal Assistant Treaty, or MLAT. It's a very slow process. So what happens is that, you know, if you need the data of XYZ, for example, it would take you 6 to 7 months to get that data and to go through the whole process. But now what has started happening is that a lot of these countries have said that this is our data, this is data of our people, and this should be stored in our respective country. So what India has, for example, come up with is a data localization provision in the draft for in the Personal Data Protection Bill 2019. It states that personal data of individuals would be stored in India, and it could be processed outside India, but the critical personal data has to be only stored in India and processed in India. But the bill does not really define what critical personal data is. In addition to that, Reserve Bank of India has a set of guidelines on processing the payments data in India.
Right.
Then the e-commerce policy, which is still, I suppose, not in play, also has a provision on data localization. So the debate essentially involves around a lot of arguments made by law enforcement agencies that it's very difficult for them to get access to certain data. And then the second part of the debate is that, you know, if it's the data of Indians, it should be stored in India. Interestingly, the European Union does, we were talking about GDPR earlier, does not really have any specific provision on data localization. But what it has is certain tests for cross-border data sharing. So, for example, adequacy test. So the data of the residents of European Union can be shared with the United States only if, you know, United States states passes those certain tests or certain parameters which have been laid down in the GDPR, which includes having adequate safeguards.
Right. And so how does the average person then unknowingly share personal data on a daily basis, and with whom do they do that? And is it possible to know about what data has been breached or compromised and by which website?
So for a lay person, I would say it's almost very unknowingly, because we need to understand that a lot of these privacy policies, etc., are very complicated and lengthy. And a lot of times they're also in English. Even I do not read a lot of privacy policies. For example, I've never read Zomato's privacy policy because they are quite long. So, you know, what we need to understand here is that a lot of this third-party data sharing does take place. And these provisions are there, these, you know, clauses are there in the privacy policies. Then take, for example, Lenskart. So they have this website where it allows you to upload your photo and see how certain glasses look on you. So what they're collecting essentially is your facial feature, which is a part of the biometric data. And while they're doing this, they do not have a privacy policy telling us, you know, how your whatever data is collected, if it is stored by them or if it is deleted immediately after you have used that service. If they're collecting your photo, are they sharing it with someone else? This is also biometric data because this is facial feature. So we don't have any clarity on that. And almost everyone who wears glasses has visited Lenskart and has tried it. So imagine the amount of data they have with themselves by now. And this is very unknowingly. This data sharing takes place very unknowingly. All of us have been, have done that at a point of time. Right. Then interestingly, you know, it's not only non-state actors or private organizations. A lot of times this happens with the state organizations as well. So take, for example, CBSE. They had come up with this facial recognition software for students. So we had filed an RTI with them. And in response to their RTI, they said that, you know, there's no privacy policy for that facial recognition software. And you need to understand this is the data of minors. You need parental consent for that. They told us that there was no parental consent sought for this facial recognition software either. And in response to that RTI, we were just told that this is a face matching software, which is why you do not need a privacy policy. A very popular example of this would nowadays be the Cowin application, which again doesn't have a privacy policy. So it links you to a very general policy on data sharing, which is the health data management policy. So, you know, it's not only on the layperson, but the onus is a lot of times also on the organizations as to why there is no privacy policy and why there is no purpose limitation or data retention provision in the privacy policy. And
but how does all of this data... Sorry, please continue. Please continue.
Yeah. So, and in answer to your second part of the question, that, you know, how can we learn about which data has been breached or compromised? So for that, there's this very interesting website, which, you know, lets you check your email breaches. It's known as haveibeenpwned.com. So it tells you if your email was in a data breach. So for example, my email was at least in 4 data breaches. So one of them was in Canva, Zomato, Dubsmash, and LumenPTA. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be very interesting for users to also check it and then see how many breaches have their email been a part of.
Right. Apurva, just coming back to all these examples of data sharing that you explained. Now, how can this impact people adversely?
Right. So when we talk about data sharing, which hasn't been authorized by our data principal or a user, it means that a lot of companies, private parties, or governments have access to your sensitive personal data, or even non-personal data for that matter. And this could be your health data, your sexual orientation, your biometric information, which Lenskart has en masse now, etc. So imagine tons of parties and a lot of malicious parties knowing about it. It's like your neighbors knowing your bank password or your kirana wala knowing what your bank password is. Except that this is in digital space where, you know, it's very difficult for you to identify that it is your kirana wala who has your password or who has access to your sensitive information. Mm-hmm. And they can use it to damage you anonymously or non-anonymously.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the government has actually... No, please continue.
Go ahead. Yeah, so what I was saying is that this is just a very small example of it. A lot of this data, you know, a lot of data sharing also takes place. So take, for example, the Vahan data, which was, so this was the data with the Ministry of Road and Transport. So this is about the licenses and people, you know, who owned these licenses and, you know, which cars, etc. So this was sold for 69 crores without the authorization of any of these data principal to private players. And then this data was available in public. And so, you know, that sort of data sharing takes place. And which is why, I mean, maybe I don't want any insurance company or car insurance company calling me about taking insurance. So that sort of data sharing, which is not authorized, can adversely impact me.
Right. Actually, since you mentioned the government, actually, the government has practically made it mandatory for citizens to share their personal data by de facto linking many services to Aadhaar. So what is your view on it? And how does this square with the Supreme Court ruling that privacy is a fundamental right?
Right. So I often wonder, I mean, how this happens, because as you would also know, in 2019, in this landmark ruling known as the Justice Puttaswamy versus Union of India, it was held that Aadhaar is mandatory only for filing IT returns, that is income tax returns, or for availing government subsidies from the Consolidated Fund of India. Now, what we have been seeing is that a lot of state governments have been making Aadhaar de facto mandatory. So take, for example, the Haryana government has made Aadhaar mandatory for Parivar Pehchan Patra, which has been gaining a lot of traction now. Then the Aadhaar was made mandatory by the Andhra government for something known as the Dharni portal, which was the portal for digitizing all the land records in Andhra Pradesh. Then Ahmedabad and Rajasthan had also made it mandatory for COVID-19 testing. Interestingly, Delhi High Court had also passed an order making Aadhaar mandatory for COVID-19 testing. So that it's obviously not legal. And it's also in violation of the Justice Puttaswamy versus Union of India as well as the Aadhaar Act. But I think one of the biggest gap here is that a lot of these state authorities, a lot of these bureaucrats or whosoever is making, you know, whosoever is drafting these guidelines at state level is not aware of these legislations. And there's a big gap here in the implementation and in the law.
Yeah, certainly. And since we're talking about the law, and you mentioned it earlier also, the government has drafted the Personal Data Protection Bill that supposedly will guarantee privacy. So what is in the bill and what is the status of the bill?
Right. So the bill is with the Joint Parliamentary Committee chaired by Lok Sabha MP from South Delhi, Ms. Meenakshi Lekhi. The Joint Parliamentary Committee was constituted in the winter session of December 2019. The committee was supposed to submit its report in the winter session of 2020, which did not take place. So we are hoping that we would be seeing a 2020 version of the 2019 bill in the budget session, which might happen sometime soon now. So the bill seeks to provide for protection of personal data of individuals and establishes a data protection authority for the same. The bill also governs the processing of personal data by government and the companies incorporated in India, as well as the foreign companies dealing with personal data of individuals in India. So personal data is data which, you know, pertains to characteristics, traits, or attributes of identities, which can be used to identify an individual. And then the bill has also categorized personal data as sensitive personal data and critical personal data. And it includes a lot of subsections of personal data, such as the financial data, biometric data, etc. And so then there is the critical data would have to be decided by the government, at least in the 2019 bill. So we are hoping that there would be some changes in the 2020 bill, and such vague definitions would not find a part in the 2020 version of the bill.
Right, right. But, you know, the bill, from what is known about it, has had its share of criticism over the intervention powers and exemptions it gives the government. For example, civil rights groups are saying that it gives the government powers to impede protection of citizens' data, and which is thus undermining the fundamental right to privacy. And the government also has the power to process individuals' personal data without their consent. So what's your take on that?
Right. So the 2019 bill, clause 35 of the 2019 bill, has given the central government very wide powers to exempt any government agency from the purview of the bill. And it does not codify the principle of necessity or proportionality as determinants to access. Now, what Section 35 of the PDP Bill 2019 does is that it has effectively enhanced existing surveillance powers of the government and has given the state an overarching authority here to access personal data. Now, there are a lot of government surveillance projects like the NADCRID, the CMS, and the Nationwide Facial Recognition Program, which will effectively enable the government to, you know, collect and process any category of personal data as per their requirements. So that even the Sri Krishna Committee, which formed the basis of the 2019 bill, had recognized that, you know, unfettered access to the government of personal data without adherence to any of the established safeguards, for example, the necessity and proportionality safeguards, is potentially unconstitutional. And I mean, this should not form a part of the, this should not have been in the 2019 bill, but we just hope that this would not be a part of the 2020 bill.
Right. Right. So Apurva, thanks so much for being on the show and explaining what is little understood but critical issue.
Thanks for having me, Ashraf. For the listeners, I would just like to plug in our digital security training sessions, which SFLC.in conducts for free of cost. So if you are a small organization or any organization, if you are an NGO, etc., and if you are just a group of individuals interested in digital security training, do write to us at mail@sflc.in about your interest in the DSTs, and we would find some time for organizing one for you. And then if you have any queries on privacy or data protection, do write to us again at mail@sflc.in, and we'd be happy to help you out with these.
Apurva, that's brilliant. And I urge all listeners to do precisely that. And thank you all for listening. Please visit www.allindiansmatter.in. That's allindiansmatter.in for more columns and audio podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Ashraf Engineer. That's ashrafenginer. And All Indians Count. That's allindianscount. Search for the All Indians Matter page on Facebook. On Instagram, the handle is All Indians Matter. Email me at editor@allindiansmatter.in. Catch you again soon.
Studios.